Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English stead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake McClure.
Whoa, we did it.
Yes.
We did it really well.
Now we've said our names and we can go home.
Yeah, that's the big accomplishment of the week, ladies and gentlemen. We have said our names in unison and in harmony.
You know how much practice it takes to say your own name. It's not an easy chore.
Right.
Most of us took many months to learn that. Not the McClures. We have taken many years.
That's right. And in order to say our names together...
We're still working on that one.
In harmony...
I don't know about the harmony part.
Well, actually, you know, we're the actual intonation there comes out sort of harmonious.
Maybe a little dissonant if you're, you know.
Well, anyway, I'm Jeff McClure, and that guy over there in the plaid is Jake, and you can tell us apart because I wear plain and he wears plaid. So everything is back to normal in the economic world because I'm wearing plain and he's wearing plaid.
Right.
We also need to tell you that the Personal Wealth Coach is an SEC-registered investment advisory firm, as well as a radio program. And we've worked on this interesting fact for a really long period of time. And it just occurred to me that there is a camera sitting here taped
pointing
at with Gorilla tape, taped sort of in, it's pointed sort of in your direction.
Yeah, I'll make faces at it.
So somebody is watching you.
I don't know. No, it's not plugged in.
Oh, that's good.
That's what the NSA wants us to think, that it's not plugged in.
Well, actually, the NSA isn't interested in what you look like. They're only interested in what you sound like.
Yes. At the office this week, there was a blue cake. It was an ice cream cake. It was a birthday party for one of the people that works there, and it's wonderful. But the blue icing turned everyone's teeth blue.
Except for those of us who didn't eat the icing.
Right. And I thought it was amazing that everyone in the office was communicating through Bluetooth.
Yes, they were. They were all using Bluetooth.
It's wireless communication vocally through Bluetooth.
Bluetooth, actually.
Yeah, Bluetooth.
Yeah, they were communicating through Bluetooth.
It was quite impressive. I didn't realize that many of them were that tech savvy.
Yeah,
but they installed it so fast and with such great relish that...
Relish?
Well, I guess relish. They relished it, but there was no... There was no relish
right,
involved.
Right, okay. Well, then there might have been. You never can tell.
We are actually going to talk about the economy.
We are?
Yes, at some point.
Do we need to?
I think otherwise no one will listen. But if we do, no one will listen.
I really think the headline in the Trader in Barron's this morning sums up the week.
Okay.
U.S. stocks fall less than 1%.
There you go. It's a good sum.
You can tell if you didn't have any idea, you didn't have a calendar and you didn't have any idea what date it was, and you just watched the news stories go by as the year progresses. As we end June and we enter into the week around which the 4th of July will be celebrated, the actual market-moving, significant economic news fizzles. And it just, I think an awful lot of people, one of the articles that was in, I don't know, the Financial Times or Wall Street Journal or something, is that Janet Yellen was taking a vacation because she'd been going through congressional hearing after congressional hearing and after congressional hearing. And so she's going to take the next couple of weeks off, basically. And basically, with the chairman of the Fed taking 2 weeks off, I think everybody else did too.
Right.
And they left the third string players to write stories.
I think the same thing is true. We've been following this Greek debate for years now, many years. It seems like it's just dragging on forever. And I think they decided that the deadline wasn't that important, that it would just take a break and cause a referendum. Let's have the people vote on this because we know how much they like to pay their debts.
Yeah, on Tuesday, they are supposed to make a 1.6 billion euro payment.
Uh-huh.
I've read also 1.4 for some reason.
Well, there's two payments.
There's two payments.
Yeah,
but the IMF, they're supposed to make a payment on Tuesday.
And the other ones, too, this is the funny thing. They're trying to organize a loan from the European Central Bank to pay the IMF. However, on the 30th, which is even closer to today, this is where we're talking about. So the day before the debt is due to the IMF, they owe the European Central Bank 300 million euros. They're trying to get the European Central Bank to give them a loan to pay the IMF the next day, but the European Central Bank wants them to pay their loan first, the $300 million, so that they'll give them a – it's kind of like the negotiations some people have with their credit card companies.
It's actually it is you know, the word farce comes to mind here.
It's a farce.
The whole point is if a country and this is another thing, and I actually have some stories in here on this. Apparently, pretty much something like 70%. Now, this is absurd, but 70% of Greeks with mortgages have stopped paying them.
Yeah.
Because the government announced that it was not going to allow the banks to wholesale go out and seize everybody's house because
right.
there's so many people who couldn't pay their mortgages.
So people that could pay their mortgage stopped
right.
paying.
And
because why not?
Yeah. And it's just kind of a that's kind of a blink. And then the banks are – there's basically – the run on the banks continues. This is just – did you hear the latest proposal that – and I think this may be intentional on the Greeks' part. But the latest proposal from the Germans and the French, basically the two prime ministers of Germany and France, are controlling – are on one side of the debate, and the prime minister of Greece is on the other side of the debate, whose name I will not attempt to pronounce. And they have this meeting with everybody, and they argue and argue and argue and get no place. And then the three of them sit down together, and then they report afterwards what the three of them supposedly said. Basically, the Greeks got offered a, we'll tide you over until November if you'll promise to do a few things. You don't actually have to do them. You just have to promise to do them. Cut pensions, throw a serious tax on businesses, and chop your public welfare, the employees that the government has rather dramatically, who, by the way, probably may not get paid this week.
Yeah, let me explain some of the background here, because a lot of the detail that we talk about is just the negotiation stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the Greek government budget is 49% of GDP.
Right.
Half of what happens in Greece is payments made by the government.
Right.
You can see a problem already. The election that took place that got Tsipras, which is the name of the prime minister you didn't want to say, because it starts with a T and it's a silent T. It's really hard to figure out.
So it's Tsipras, and then the name of the party is Syriza?
Yes.
Tsipras of Syriza.
Right.
That's too many S's.
Yeah. The unemployment rate in Greece when he was elected was about 28%.
Okay.
His party won the election with 26% of the vote. There may not be a correlation there, but it looks like all the unemployment people got together and voted for this guy who said that he didn't want to continue with austerity. So that's one of the issues here.
Maybe they thought he said, we don't want to continue being Austria.
It could be.
Okay.
It could be, yes. And now,
but he said it in Greek.
Over the time since 2009, the Greeks have renegotiated their debt twice.
Mm-hmm.
They call it a haircut. They took a 50% haircut. If I
right.
went to the barber, I don't have any hair.
Now, you're not going to get a 50% haircut.
But if I decided that I needed to get 50% of myself taken off, that's a little bit more than a haircut. That is half of which torso part are you losing here?
That's a scalping.
Yes. But, so they called it a haircut. But this is what's going on. And then now they're trying to push back the date at which they owe this debt. They say, can we move it back to the 30th of June? Because somehow the extra...
Well, no, that's been kind of given
okay,
at this
point.
Okay,
so they went from the 6th...
Of June.
Of June. They said, let's renegotiate this. Let's push it back to the 30th of June.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so because this is somehow, with these 24 extra days, we're going to be able to figure something out. So they did. And now they're saying, let's push it back again until midway through next month when we have everybody vote to see whether or not we want to pay the debt that we owe. The issue here seems pretty clear to me, that the Greeks have this habit And it's a habit they've had for a very long time. They have had deficits in up years and down years. They've created bigger deficits and bigger deficits and bigger deficits. And even when they do austerity to cut, the rest of their economy shrinks faster than the cuts being made to the government. So the government's percentage of the GDP keeps getting bigger. It is... what I don't understand, though, is why the Europeans don't just forgive all the debt. Well, they've already forgiven half of it, well, and then actually, another half of it. Why don't they just say, okay, you guys don't owe any more, but we don't want you around. Go away.
Actually, if they turn around and forgive half of existing debt, the matter of fact, the Financial Times said, just do it, like you just said. They said, that's the only way out of this. But the problem is, again, it will be very expensive in two ways if they do, and this is why they don't do it. One, again, as I have mentioned before, while it's officially been written down now.
Written down means haircut
debt,
or whatever you want to call it.
In other words, if
the slaying of the debt.
A given bank, let's say, is holding €1 billion, and that's not unusual, €1 billion of sovereign debt from Greece,
right,
which they would normally carry at €1 billion value,
mm-hmm,
by law.
Yep.
And then, so it's been cut down. I think it was actually about a 40% haircut they had before. So now it's down
there
to six.
Two. Yeah, one.
But anyway, they're down to, the paper is now down to €600 billion of debt. And for every six, if they cut it again, somebody has got to come up with the €3 billion to replace the paper in that bank, which would suck down the economy of Europe
million.
Again.
Yeah, you're correct here, and this is to a point, but you're mixing the debt. Some of the debt is owed directly to the European Central Bank. Some of it's to the IMF, but 86% of their debt is owed to the public. So this debate is only about 14% of the debt of the Greeks, and it's only the debt to governmental agencies or the IMF.
Well, an awful lot of
the Troika.
An awful lot of Greek sovereign debt has wound up in institutions. The vast majority of it, and those institutions, as I've said before, by law in the Eurozone, carry it at face value.
Yep.
Now, they've officially adjusted the face value at some point, but if they adjust it again, then somebody has got to replace a relatively, it's not an earth-shaking amount of money, but it's a significant amount of money when you're in an economy that has just barely crawled out of severe deflation.
They're back in it again.
And the
Greeks
European
are.
Economy. I'm talking about the European economy. And this is the other thing. This is the biggie. It's the moral risk issue, in that you've got the Spain is going through austerity with a 30% unemployment rate, paying off its debt. Portugal is paying off its debt.
Right.
The Irish are paying off the debt. And by the way, when they sit down at these councils, do you know who the hardliners are on the other side of the table from the Greeks?
The Irish, the Spanish, and the Portuguese.
And the Portuguese. They are the people who refuse to budge, saying, look, if we're doing it, you can do it, because your citizens are receiving far greater benefits from your government than ours are.
Right. And that's another thing. When Tsipras was elected, he was elected on this concept of lowering taxes. And it didn't get passed. But people stopped paying their taxes anyway.
Right. Well, that was a form of lowering taxes.
So what I meant about mixing the debt, though, is that the debt held by the public is the stuff, the sovereign debt at these banks. It's sitting out there at the bank. They're renegotiating the different debt, the debt to the Troika, the three, the European Committee, the European Central Bank, and the IMF. They're not renegotiating the private debt yet.
But they've
already taken these big haircuts on them. Basically,
what happened is all the creditors got together and agreed to take a loss on part of the money that the Greeks owed them. But in order to take a loss on the rest of it, since it's being held in a lot of institutions as their reserves, then they have this little problem. And the problem is that if somebody doesn't replace that money, and the institutions in many cases would be able to replace the money. It's just they would have to stop making loans to the public. You know, in other words, you got a bank. Bank makes loans, but for every loan they make, they have to have a certain amount of reserves in case the loan fails. And in part of the reserves that they hold are Greek sovereign debt. And if that just suddenly goes to zero or effectively goes to 50% of its value, well, somebody's got to replace that money or they stop making loans. And when they stop making loans, then Europe goes back into recession. Now,
yeah, that's already happened once, that 50% mm-hmm. reduction.
Right.
And that's already had the private debt is the 50% reduction.
Right.
The European Union, the IMF, and the European Committee have also taken the 40% cut.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two different things that have happened.
But the point is, across the board, somebody has got to bite the bullet on this at some point. And the Financial Times had a very interesting commentary on it, as did, I think, Barron's, when they said this is what's really going on here. Is they're trying to kick the can far enough down the road that the Eurozone economies recover to the point where they can afford to take the loss without putting them back into recession.
Right.
The question is, how do you do that? And it is really, it is very much like a bank not wanting to foreclose on somebody's house because they realize the house is worth a lot less than the loan value.
Right. And they want to wait for somebody to fix it up right. a little bit before they foreclose.
And the longer, because once they foreclose on this house where they're going to take a huge loss, it shows up on their earnings statement.
Yeah.
So it would be in the bank's best interest to drag their feet. Meanwhile, the people who are paying the mortgage might decide, well, okay.
We're not paying the mortgage anymore. And what's more, it's not our house anymore, so we're going to trash it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what the Greeks are doing.
And the Greeks are headed off in that direction. It's really...
You know, Machiavelli said something.
It is really a fascinating story with the Greeks. And I frankly cannot imagine how it turns out with anything other than a Greek default.
Right. Everybody keeps saying kick the can down the road. Machiavelli said something that was very clear. And depending on which translation, you get different quotes on what it is. But basically what he said is that if there is a known fight, you know you're going to have to make a fight. Don't delay.
Mm-hmm.
That only gives your opposition time to get stronger. And right now, that's what the banks are doing. If they're delaying on letting the economy fail. Now that right now, the European economy is relatively weak. But if they continue to let the Greeks spend what they don't have, it's only going to get worse for the Greeks, which is going to make it worse for the other people around them. And the Russians are going to get more involved. The number one import partner of Greece, the ones that sell the most stuff to the Greeks, are the Russians. They sell 12.9% of GDP to the Greeks, and that's mostly in oil and gas. So one of these really nice customers of the Russians is in trouble, and we know what the Russians like to do to their nice customers that are in trouble. If the European Union...
They take over the government.
If the European Union doesn't fill that vacuum because the government of Greece is not doing it, if we don't... If the, mm-hmm. the debtors don't get together and pay and the creditors don't collect, it's just causing a massive structural weak point in the whole foundation of what is the European Union. It's not going to go away. The cracks don't get bigger or don't get smaller on their own when you get this kind mm-hmm. of... So if they don't fix it it's going to get worse.
And I really strongly suspect that Putin is goading the Greeks. There's another little in this interesting drama that goes on. There's another little factor in there. The Greek finance minister is an expert in game theory.
I think he's gaming it.
Yes, he's definitely doing it.
He
is gaming it. He's playing the Russians against the Europeans.
Right.
But this is from a much bigger historical perspective. This is how World War One got started.
Yes, it is. It is. A basket case of a tiny little country that nobody really cared about was having a debate on who owed what to whom when an assassination took place.
Yeah. And I don't know who the person that would get assassinated, because basically it was the peacemaker going, you know, at Merkel being assassinated,
if Merkel,
for example.
Was assassinated, or if Kerry or some high-level diplomat that was coming to try to solve the problem were assassinated, that would cause a war. It would cause a massive war.
And particularly if the person who assassinated them was Russian.
Yes, absolutely.
That's what would – and it's just – it's just an awkward position, and
hopefully Putin knows that any kind of disruption on that level right now would cause cascade of events.
I'm confident. The issue is, though, and the American Civil War, if you trace it back all the way to its the earliest actions, and
right.
I may have mentioned this before, the earliest actions that triggered a chain of events that ultimately wound up with us having a civil war was a brinksmanship battle between Calhoun and Jackson.
Yes, it was over the
tariffs of 1833.
Yeah, and over the equivalent of the Federal Reserve, only it was the Second National Bank.
Well, that was the second shot in the war. The first
right.
one, the first one, was the tariff of 1833. Calhoun got it shoved through Congress, which would terribly damage the South.
Right.
Knowing that Jackson would have to veto it so that he could use it, he could use the political embarrassment of having to veto this tariff, which the northern merchants had wanted.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted the tariff, and he wanted to use that to undercut his support in the North.
Right.
And
what he did instead was cause the North and the South
right.
to really get a schism.
But what actually happened is Jackson decided not to veto it because he hated Calhoun. And so he didn't veto it, and it torpedoed the Southern economy and entrenched slavery, and a lot of things went on from there. And we're still fighting over that.
Yes,
this week.
We still are.
It's interesting. There were terrorist attacks that were scattered almost at the same moment, which makes a person at least to suspect, given the history,
there may have been
a coordination
yeah.
here, with ISIS in three different countries. And that coincided with a person in the United States killing nine people in a prayer meeting in a church in South Carolina. Do I think he was coordinated with ISIS? No. But I think it's fascinating that we have people resulting – and by the way, the objective here in all cases is to start a local war.
Right. He wanted – the man in the United States wanted to start a race war.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to say his name.
Roof.
I don't want to get – part of the reason why these folks do that is so that people will talk about them on the radio.
Well, he he definitely did something. But there's a big plus to this. In South Carolina, and this was actually in the Wall Street Journal today, Peggy Noonan had a column on it, either today or Friday, I don't remember which. The amazing thing was, instead of triggering a racial war and division, this massacre triggered an outpouring of forgiveness
right.
and bonding, and a movement towards sanity that we haven't seen in a long time. A lot of people don't know in South Carolina, by the way, the Confederate flag that's up on the state the state capitol's grounds was not put up following the Civil War.
No.
It was put up in the late 1960s. As a symbol of opposition to the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
And that's all it is. It has nothing to do with the tradition of the Civil War. By the way, for whatever it's worth, South Carolina's units in the Civil War did not carry that flag.
No. It's a different flag completely.
They carried a state flag and a stars and bars flag, which looks a bit like the Texas flag. And they didn't carry the Confederate battle flag. But it's really interesting that we see a movement towards moderation popping up following this event rather than the traditional recriminations and finger-pointing that right. normally comes in. Matter of fact, the only finger-pointing was a guy named, I think, Joseph Cotton was his name. I don't know if you heard from the National Rifle Association yeah. Board of Directors, who said that the preacher brought it on himself.
That was dumb. That was not the smartest thing he could have said.
Not exactly a brilliant statement yeah. from the National Rifle Association.
Both of us, if you're curious out there, listeners, both of us strongly support the right to keep and bear arms.
Yes.
It is not something that we consider a question. The idea that a prayer group brought murder on themselves,
yeah,
that's stupid.
Because they weren't carrying weapons.
Right. That's just dumb. Yeah, that's like saying the only reason why you got attacked is because you weren't armed. No, it's the right of us to carry arms. But just because you have the right to do it, you also have the right to not do it if you want. To say that everyone must carry weapons or they will be murdered, you're going to bring it on yourself, that's dumb. We should live in a society where enough people choose to do it that the criminals can't get away with it. But to say that everybody, I mean, I've got a daughter that's 5 months old, and she's not carrying weapons.
She's not, well.
She's bringing it on herself. I mean.
She has a certain chemical weapon capability that all
true.
Babies have.
That is true.
But we need to break for commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be talking about the economy, and there's actually a few things happened during the week that have something really to do with the economy.
Right.
They're not anywhere near as interesting as talking about Greeks and ISIS and all of that, but they're real. And
they're real. I think they're more interesting because they're actually having an impact, and the other things are just kind of dragging on.
Yeah, but the other things make a psychological impact. So,
yes,
okay, we'll be back on the other side. Telephone numbers in here, if today is Saturday, June 27th, where you are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
We'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone numbers in here are still 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And there's actually some things going on in the world that I think are significant. We talked about the fact that the stock market is down about 1% for the week. That's real. That's one of those factors in the world. It's up. It's still up just barely year to date. The S&P and the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and a lot of people that I've talked to are a little bit concerned when they look around and they get this, for some reason or other, they're getting an impression that the market should be up because the stock market is near record highs. They say this over and over again. Well, that's wonderful, but the record highs were at the beginning of the year. And they really weren't that much higher than they were at the end of the year. And as a result, the stock market is in sort of idle mode at this point. And this is a not abnormal, that's an interesting way of putting it, I've always thought, a not abnormal, but not quite normal way that markets do. The stock market is hysterically and historically has had one of these pauses. When it transitions from recovery to expansion, and the signs are all there that we will see an expansion in stock values coming down the road, and it probably should happen relatively abruptly because that's the way it happens. But somehow, I think a lot of people expect to see if the stock market over a long period of time is averaging 6% or 10% or whatever it's doing in a given period of time, they expect that that should be divided up by 12 and they should get 1/12 of that each month. Well, it's not even close to true because we don't even get one of it each year. What we get is, as I tell people, it's really important to look at a five-year moving average. An average, a minimum 5 years, actually 10 is better. And then take a look at what your account has done. And you get a much better feel for what's going on in the real world out there. What's going, how the market operates. Markets operate like the weather. Those of you who have any long-term memory left at all will remember that we just went through 5 years of really nasty drought. And the lakes all sort of semi-dried up. And if you go out and look at Belton or Stillhouse now, you see that they're over full. And it's real easy to, in the near future, to get focused on the fact that it rains too much here in Texas. That's the nature of weather, and that's the nature of the markets. We're going through this quiet period of not very near zero returns in the market. And a lot of people don't like that, because particularly if you're taking money out consistently, you're going to see you're taking money out faster than your accounts are making money right now. That's all right. The long-term average is what's important, and it really pays to pay attention to that and just be aware of it. There's really not much to say about the market, the stock market this year so far, except that it is treading water. Incidentally, for whatever it's worth, the earnings per share are going up, and there is somebody buying stocks out there. I don't know if you knew that or not. It's the corporations buying their own
stocks. Yeah, they're buying it back. Part of the mergers and acquisition, people talk about the mergers and acquisition trend going on right now. It starts when a company buys its own stock, because they're looking around and they're saying, this stock is worth a lot more than what people say it is, so I'm going to buy it for my own treasury. And what that does to their existing shareholders is each share that they have buys more, is more ownership in the company. And that's it's a pretty cool event, except that it doesn't cause the company itself to get more profitable. It doesn't cause the company to create any more value. It causes them just, it's kind of a trick that they do to cause their shareholders to be happy instead of spending that money on making themselves a better company. And I think that it has a lot to do with the way cash is being treated right now. They're afraid that if they spend cash on something and they don't have enough cash left over at the end, that they're not going to be able to get a debt to make payroll, because we've just been through a great recession and nobody wants to be back in that position.
And the other thing, that the reason that I'm very optimistic about the future on the market, is there's growing quantities of cash sitting on the sidelines. Americans continue to pay down their debts. We, by the way, there's a really fascinating number that I saw.
Three.
The Federal Reserve announced, I think it was last week, and I don't have the numbers right here, it's either $84 or $87 trillion. I think it was $87 trillion was the net worth of American households. 87. Now get that. Listen to this again. Net worth, that is assets minus liabilities of households. We're not talking about corporations here.
Right.
$87 trillion. Now, why is that? That's a big number by itself, which kind of puts the deficit and everything else in perspective. But there's another aspect to that that I think is very, very, very important. In 2009, the net worth of American households was $30 trillion less than it is now.
Yeah. Now, we've had a big recovery.
$30 trillion has been added to the balance sheet in sense of equity in American households in 6 years. That is one of those numbers that I think should be, I realize people wouldn't understand.
That's a lot of zeros. Nobody understands that many zeros.
And there's aspects to it that are kind of strange, which, by the way, is why home builders are building mansions. They're building McMansions all over the country.
Right.
They're not building smaller houses, and their response is people with low income. And basically, the rich are getting, people with low income are not trying to buy houses. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of investors in the United States. This is part of why the net worth has gone up. Apparently, a lot of individuals and companies have been formed to buy houses at rock-bottom prices, low-end houses. In many cases, they've been foreclosed on or on the verge of foreclosure. People just want out of the house. They cut a deal, buy the house, fix it up, and rent it. So we're having this conversion of home ownership to rental use across the country.
Because the low-income people can't get loans right now.
Right. And they, in many cases, people don't want to sell their houses. This is a, something that came out, too. A very significant portion of American homes do not have enough sale equity in them at this point to walk away with 20% of the value. In other words, if the people in the house try to buy the house they were in, they couldn't afford to do it. And then when people are in that position where they can't walk away with 20% of the value, because when I say walk away, the 20% of the value is going to include the realtor's charge, which is typically around 6%, which only leaves you 14%. But by the time you get through all the rest of the closing costs, you basically, if a person can't walk away with 10% of the value of the house, this is a key point. They can't afford to buy another house when they sell this one, which means that they tend to sit on their house. And the other thing, another thing that's really fascinating to me economically.
It's dangerous, by the way, to sit on your house, particularly if you have a
sit in their house.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's
But there's another aspect to this. Apparently, low interest rates, I always thought low interest rates resulted in more sales of houses because it was lower house payments.
It would if people could qualify for the loans or if the bank felt like they could make a profit by making a loan to somebody at risk.
This is one of the factors that came out in this conference this week. A bunch of economists who specialize in real estate and home builders and everything got together, and they said, here's the issue. You know, like on my house, I have a 3.25% mortgage.
Right.
I'm really happy with my 3.25% mortgage.
The bank's not really happy with your 3.25% mortgage, though.
Now, here's the issue. If I went to buy, I was looking at what would happen if I went to buy a new house and I realized I'd pay a higher mortgage interest rate buying a new house today than on the house I'm in, which makes me, and apparently a lot of other people, not that I'm interested in selling my house because I really like it, but it would make me really, really, really hesitant.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't. For the same house payment, if I took all my equity and I moved it over to, and I was somehow able to avoid paying a realtor and everything else, and I moved it over to another house, I would have of exactly the same value. I'd have a higher house payment.
This is part of the reason why the rental side of the market is getting so much hotter. It's happening so much faster. People are going in and they're saying, I want to buy a new house. But I don't want to get rid of the house that has the 3.25% mortgage on it because I can't get better than that.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do instead is see if I can charge rent on that house while I'm buying a bigger house and use the rent to help offset the increase in interest rate.
Well, and this is a factor in a very practical sense today. I've spoken to people recently who are interested in selling their house and land that they have under it, and which is a good idea to do at the same time, although that's not the way it's always done. But the point is they're trying to recover some value out of their property because they want to use it for something else. And in some cases, they've been talking about delaying that. Bad move. As interest rates come up, and this is one of the reasons we're going to probably see a very slow recovery continue. As interest rates come up, houses go down in value because the actual payment rises with interest rates. So
right. People don't buy a house based on the price tag of the house. They buy the house based on what they can afford in monthly payments.
Well, now there's one exception to that.
There's several exceptions.
People with a lot of money who are paying cash for their house.
Right. If you've got a lot of money to put as a down payment or just pay cash outright, then it is the price tag. Mm-hmm. And those are the people. Then when people talk about
rich who's buying
keep getting
houses.
Richer. Yeah, in this environment, if you have a lot of money, it's really good for you. And it's kind of a tough situation. And people say, well, isn't it always the case that if you have a lot of money, it's a good environment? Well, no, actually it isn't. If you have a deflationary trend, which is what we're going through right now, If you have a lot of money and you do nothing with it, the next day your money is worth more than it was. You can do more with that money. In an inflationary trend, well, let me finish the deflation. Mm-hmm. If you get a 30-year loan and we have deflation, then over that period, your employer will pay you less because each dollar is worth
right.
more. But you have a contract with the bank to pay your mortgage, and that doesn't change. In an inflationary trend, you may have a 30-year loan, and that's a fixed loan that says this is the payment you've got to do, and your payment goes up even if you don't do anything better at the work because inflation's there. They have to pay you more to keep you there. And that's actually better for low-income people. But if you have a lot of cash and you buy a house right now, then it doesn't matter that interest rates go up. It doesn't matter that you have deflation. In fact, it's actually good for you all the way around. So this is one of the reasons why we talk about deflation being much more dangerous for the overall economy, because it stifles innovation. It stops the people that, you know, this is probably as fundamental as I'm going to get today.
Are you becoming a fundamentalist?
In many ways.
Oh, okay.
Our innovation in the United States is not brought on in most part by large corporations. Our innovation happens at the small level. People that are not doing well, and people can talk about the American dream is dead and all of that, I just say, wait a minute. Look at the richest people in the United States, and where did they start? And if you're not talking about the Waltons with Walmart, and you go back one generation and he was poor, if you're talking about Michael Dell or Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, or you can just keep going, Zuckerberg and so on, these are people that started with relatively little amounts, and they innovated something amazing, and they did it at a time when they were really bored, either unemployed or in school. It's amazing how those two coincide so often.
Well, most people in school are not full-time employees.
That's true. So they have time on their hands to do something. And if they had a job, they wouldn't have done it. If they had a good-paying job, their time would be all taken up by doing that job. So this concept of stifling innovation, if we have deflation, it makes it harder to do that. It causes people to need the job more to get the money to do what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ford is another example.
McCormick.
If you go back to the panic of 1907, this is what led to Ford starting a company.
Mm-hmm. And the McCormick Reaper was invented by, I think it was John McCormick, and the cotton gin.
Yeah.
Both invented because of the Depression of 1837, where a couple of guys lost their jobs.
Right. If you look at the great innovation that we have, it comes from turmoil in the economy. So that's you said there's a plus out there. There is a plus. We have a massive amount of innovation that's coming up. And just mention the word drone, and this is something that hobbyists are starting companies that will at someday be the big companies that we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Because they started them at a time when they were laid off at some company and said, well, while I'm laid off, I'll do this. That's how we innovate. But to be afraid of inflation at this period means that we're afraid of the wrong thing. We need to be looking at deflation, because that's mm-hmm. the thing that will stifle the innovation.
And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Again, the telephone numbers are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
On this Saturday, June 27th. Speaking of inflation,
mm-hmm.
The Federal Reserve targets a specific inflation rate called the PCE, which is kind of like what were you talking about, the TAA and the
TPP and TPP, the TPA.
Yeah, and all that. Well, okay, well, this is the PCE, which is the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index. And it is.
That's a mouthful.
Which I actually like a lot better than the Consumer Price Index.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to follow.
because it basically says, what do people spend, what do consumers in the United States spend money on? And rather than coming up with some artificial number, which, by the way, was started by Herbert Hoover,
right,
which is a consumer price index.
Well, he talks about baskets all the time, and
yes,
the Herbert Hoover index, and people don't really use those except at the beginning of spring for
right.
Easter occasionally
well, actually,
anymore.
They're starting to in Austin, I understand.
Yeah, there are some right. good basket weavers in Austin. Yeah.
And so, since they banned bags.
Right, you just show up with your basket.
Right, so the point is that the personal consumption expenditure price index basically says how much are people spending on specific items each month. They do a survey, and they weigh the price index strictly according to how much you're spending on it, so that they get a number that reflects pretty much what happens in the average American's expenditure budget each week. And they don't, for example, in the consumer price index, one of the biggest factors is the rent value of your home, which is one of the most absurd artificial factors I've ever run
right.
across.
Let me explain that for a second. If you own a home and you're living in it, you don't say, my rent value is X, because you're living in the home. You're not getting mm-hmm. rent from the home.
But the point is that to get the consumer price index, they come up with an artificial rent value and pretend like you're paying it.
Yes.
Anyway, so this personal consumer, personal consumption expenditure, if I can remember
PCE.
That. PCE. Is running at about 0.2% year over year right now. In other words, month to month, there's numbers that come out, and I'm sure they're very interesting to a lot of people because they generate a lot of newsprint and a lot of discussion, but those aren't important. What's important is how much did the stuff you buy every month cost compared with what it cost the same stuff, which is one of the terms we use in economics.
Right.
Year ago.
I like stuff a lot better than trimmed mean.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Well, the trimmed mean PCE.
It's reversion to the mean. So.
Right.
0.2% is our effective inflation rate compared with where we were last year. Now, I want you to remember something, if there's anybody listening.
I'm not.
Remember when Glenn Beck was screaming about runaway inflation and the collapse of the dollar? And a lot of the right-wing talking heads across the country weren't using their heads. They were just talking. And they were scaring you to death about the collapse of the dollar, and the dollar was going to lose all its value, and we were going to have runaway inflation. And I don't know if you can remember back 6 years ago when
That's
they were
a long
saying
time.
That.
I'm not ready to
But they were saying that 6 years ago, and we were in complete disagreement with them and said the danger was deflation, not inflation. Folks, the dollar has risen phenomenally against literally
everything.
Every currency in the world. And inflation is so low, it's almost zero. And that's the reality, not what the right-wing talking heads are saying.
Or the left-wing talking heads,
I don't
for
know.
That matter.
I wasn't
Although
listening.
They don't really, the left-wing doesn't really have talking heads. They don't really have heads. They just run around in circles
I
screaming.
I have not been able to find a left-wing talking head to listen to.
Yeah, you've got right-wing talking heads and left-wing, they don't have heads. So yeah, either way, it's
Bernie,
absurd. Both sides are absurd.
Bernie Sanders is the closest thing I can get to that, and I listen to one of his speeches or read one of his speeches, and when he was done, I wasn't sure what he said. So, you know, the left wing.
You just defined all politics to me. I mean, they talk, and I'm like, God, they put words together, and it kind of roused some kind of emotion, but I'm not sure what they said.
Now, I've listened to several right wing politicians lately, and I understand what they were trying to say, and it was idiocy or lies. I'm not sure which. But
the left wing's just as bad.
Well, it may be just as bad. I just can't find any of them to listen to.
They're just not coordinated enough to talk.
And we're almost out of time for this hour. And, of course, we got a call on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Caller, you're on the air?
Yes. I was wondering if you could tell me if company spins off Company Z and Company Z goes up by 60%. How does the shareholder of Company P benefit from that? Thank you, and I'll hang up
okay.
and listen.
Right. Company
Thanks
P shareholder call. Should have gotten, in the spinoff, should have gotten shares of Company Z.
Yeah.
as part of the spinoff.
Yeah, basically what they do is they don't take ownership away from the people that already own it. They split the ownership so that now you own two entities instead of one.
If you've been owner of AT&T when they split it up, you had a whole stack of stocks that have split again since then, and you have an accounting nightmare.
Yes, it's one of the first things that I did working in the investment world was to try to sort together where the baby bells were and who owned what. Yes. So we're about out of time for this hour.
And you've been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach for the first hour. We'll be back next hour. You can give us a call off the air at 947-1111 or
toll free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us. That's also on the air or off the air. Jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and listen to podcasts, read about us, see our ugly mugs. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.